Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk with Marcus Sidhu, who's the book writer of the musical Allegiance. In reviews, we talk about Midsummer Night's Dream at the Pearl, Desire, The New Morality at the Mint Theater Company, and Reasons to be Pretty. That plus a little bit of news. Please stay tuned.
There once was a little girl playing on a swing set that her grandpa built by the sycamore tree near the rusty farmyard gate.
Welcome to Broadway Videos, this week on Broadway for Sunday, September 20th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Kreutzerland, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk and Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and many other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
With us today, we have a very special guest. Marcus Sidhu is with us. He is the book writer of the new musical Allegiance, which opens up November 8th at the Long Acre. He won the Helen Hayes Award for Best New Play with his comedy, Birds of a Feather. And recently, he wrote the concert adaptation of Lerner and Lowe's 1951 classic, Paint Your Way, and for City Center's Encores. He also wrote a book to A Room with a View, which played at the Fifth Avenue Theater in Seattle and the Old Globe in San Diego. Those are some, you know, really... You got to get better theaters, right, Mark? You know?
I'm doing what I can. I'm doing what I can.
Low-rent theaters there, Fifth Avenue and Old Globe. Oh, my goodness. And Mark's one-man musical adaptation of his award-winning novel, How I Paid for College, debuted at the Hub Theater. His novel of the same name won the Ken Kesey. Is it Ken Kesey Award for Fiction?
Ken Kesey, who wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Cuckoo's Nest, Jim.
Yeah. I'm so bad at pronouncing names. If you weren't a fellow paisan, I would have gotten your name wrong.
You got it right, though. You got it right.
And he was the New York Times editor's choice and spawned a sequel novel, Attack of the Theater People. We're going to have to talk about that. So, Ken, thank you. Ken, yeah. Mark, thank you for joining us on a Sunday morning. We're stumbling through life right now.
That's all right. If we could get Ken here too, that'd be fantastic because he had all those LSD stories in the 1960s. So I'm sure that'd be a very interesting interview, far more than I.
Did you have to take LSD to deal with the musical about Japanese internment? It would seem to be an unlikely topic for a musical.
You know, it is counterintuitive. On the surface, absolutely, but it's. Ultimately, it actually works remarkably well. I'm a silver lining kind of guy, and I moved to New York at mid-career. You know, I was a novelist and a journalist, and I moved to New York at midlife. This is my midlife crisis, writing for the theater. And I am incredibly attracted to material that uplifts and inspires. It's just... the way I'm wired, I have a sort of, you know, cockeyed optimism, if you will, and I'm just increasingly frustrated that all too often in entertainment, and I'd say in the theater in particular, that there's a great divide between serious, substantive work and lightweight work, and that often lightweight work often it becomes the domain of optimism. And in order to be a serious person, you have to be a pessimist or a nihilist, and ne'er the twain shall meet. And it's almost as if Oscar Hammerstein had never existed. The idea that you could write a serious, substantive musical about an important subject and yet actually find the uplift in it. So this project came to me, but it dovetailed perfectly with my mission to be able to create that kind of work.
Mm. Now, under these circumstances, I remember reading your novel when it came out, and it was terrifically funny. It wouldn't seem to me that people would say about a musical that seems serious, "We got to get a Cito." That's all there is to it. So, how did it come to you?
Yes, I agree. It does seem like it's a weird part of my overlap. Although George Takei, who inspired the project, is enormously funny, so there is a comedy DNA that where the two of us connect.
Oh, good.
The part where I think where they sought me out was I had my production of Ian Forrester's A Room with a View being produced at the Old Globe shortly before the team Allegiance was about to have their world premiere, and they were looking for a playwright. Part of a consequence of my career, because I have a lifelong obsession with story structure, I like to take it apart like some people take apart toasters and clocks. So as a result, I've coached literally hundreds of writers of all mediums to tell their stories. They knew this about me. They knew that I had this particular facility and this obsession. So they were looking for someone to come in and really help shape the narrative. Yeah, you're absolutely right. The idea that they'd say this is, you know, epic family story setting or historical period may not seem like the likely subject. But it's opened up a whole other door in my career, though, I have to say. I find myself now completely obsessed with historical subjects.
Well, that's good in the age of Hamilton.
When did you first learn that these camps existed? I remember when I first heard about them, I was in my 20s, and I was appalled. Did you hear about this some time ago or not until this show came up?
I knew about this when there was a movie that came out in 1990 with Dennis Quaid, which was really my first introduction to it. But like so many Americans, I never learned about this in school. Mm. Appallingly so. I grew up in a very preppy town in New Jersey that actually... The Holocaust wasn't even on the curriculum in my high school, which is, you know,
mind-boggling,
appalling. Yeah. It's a chapter of the history that I think often gets overlooked. The part of it, though, that I find even more overlooked and fascinating was the fortitude of the Japanese American people. That while there is this villainy of the American government and this grave injustice, the story that I was attracted to and that George absolutely is a living embodiment of is the spirit of Gaman, which is to endure with dignity.
Mm-hmm.
The detail that I heard from George that made me say, wow, I know I can write this show, was that when Japanese Americans were put into the camps, they had such a surplus of crops. They were farmers from the West Coast, and they got crops to grow in the most barren, hard ground. And as a result, they had such a surplus, they donated them to the American military. Mm. And that sense of grace and forgiveness and dignity slays me every time. And I just thought, you know, I can understand. That I can get my head around.
For my part, I seem to remember that I did learn to some extent about the internment camps in school, but it was very, very glossed over. And I think it was presented to us that the camps were instituted to protect the Japanese Americans. So I'm sure that we will probably see a somewhat more nuanced portrayal in Allegiance.
Well, one of the reasons that we've discovered that it makes for such a good musical is that the Japanese people and Japanese American people, the culture, is a rather subdued culture. They are not people who express themselves in an overt way. which it was interesting having worked on Room of the View, which was about a bunch of, you know, Victorians and Edwardians who also suffer from this kind of expressive repression. So in a way, a musical was the perfect way to tell the story, because in a musical, you can pop open people's heads and souls and let the internal truth come out. So after a while, after working on it, we all said, you know what, this is sort of the perfect way. Because otherwise, like, if you have seen any of the films or about it, or even any of the books, there's a lot of sort of stoic people not expressing themselves. It's hard. It makes for difficult drama.
So you've been referred to as, if you forgive the expression, the gay Dave Barry, and Dave Barry is mostly known as a comical writer who is got insights into people's lives. And how did that fit in with the way in which you approach the book for Allegiance? Because it's easier to tell a difficult story to an audience with a little bit of humor. And how do you find the humor there? And was there a lot of back and forth between you and the rest of the creative team on how to achieve a goal there?
We kind of put the characters on the sort of the what we think of as the hope crap continuum, which is, you know,
amazing. Yeah, I love that.
Right. So they, you know, they think they're very hopeful, and then there's a lot of crap, and then they're very hopeful, and there's a lot of crap. You know, and the fact is, they did bloom where they were planted, and they did have dances, and they did fall in love, and there were babies born, and they, you know, they really strived for that kind of humanity. And that, like I said, being a silver lining kind of guy is very much my MO. So it was, I found it actually very easy for me to find the uplift in the story. It's right there in front of us. And I was just, how do I put this to you guys? It was an inspiring spirit. This sounds so corny, so forgive me if it sounds cornball, but that particular spirit, it was so ebullient and so evident. We didn't I'm sorry, I'm stumbling with this.
That's okay.
I think what it is, I'm very moved by it. I'm having a slightly existential moment here, because I'm thinking, oh my God, it's true. There are people who think I'm the gay Dave Barry, and there's this whole other part of me, which is really had a chance to have voice in this show. It's like, you know how like we were taught in elementary school how the Native Americans used the whole buffalo? I feel like this is a project where I'm allowed to use the whole buffalo, and I get choked up talking about it, because it's a chance to really use other muscles that I have as a writer. I loved being called the gay Dave Barry, and I actually, when I met Dave Barry, I told Dave Barry this very proudly, and he looked me in the eye and he said, okay, I just want to tell you, I've heard of you, and I want to let you know I'm the gay Dave Barry.
I knew that was coming.
And then he's so gracious. He signed his book. I was at a book signing, and so I handed him a copy of his book, which he then signed, The Straight Marcosito, which he talked about how he wanted to get together an event where, you know, because a lot of people, you know, the straight Dave Barry, or excuse me, the gay Dave Barry, or there's the female Dave Barry, the Asian Dave Barry. He said he wanted to put together like a concert one night where like all of us who had been called Dave Barry came together and had our sort of a smackdown, you know, to see who's the Barriest of the Dave Barrys. But I always apologize though with my novels when they came out as well, that I was always nervous about doing interviews, because I'm not an especially hilarious person to talk to. It, like a lot of funny people, I'm actually deadly serious. It's just that then the humor is a defense mechanism. I get my back against the wall and suddenly jokes come out. So and it's a sort of a long-winded way of saying, like, where do you find the humor in the Japanese-American internment? But, you know, there's a lot of back-against-the-wall moments in this show. And as a result, it suddenly, you know, it lets the jokes fly. So who would have thunk, you know?
Well, I would highly, highly recommend both of those books to everyone. They're absolutely hysterical. How I Paid for College, which the title may not necessarily prepare you for what you're going to read about, but believe me, it's worth it. And the other one I love, because I think Mark and I have discussed it, it's Attack of the Theater People, which obviously is a takeoff on, Attack of the whatever, the cat people or the people from another world. But that's so hilarious because theater people is a phrase that everyone, mm-hmm. I think, all use, but then to recast it in, like, you know, these aliens, like people from another world, the title alone was so brilliant. I thought, oh, this is going to be another really great book.
Well, when you look at the controversy over the AT&T ad about looking at the sports phone during
oh my god, yes.
What I thought was so amazing about all the back and forth online was it really did seem like the theater nerds taking down the jocks. I just thought we all just went right back to high school, you know, and like this, like, latent, you know, there's Patti LuPone smacking people down online, but you could almost feel that sense of, like, you know, anger at, like, you know, the cheerleaders, like, you know, how dare you, you know.
Absolutely.
Mark, were you a Star Trek fan? Did George's name mean anything to you?
I'm ashamed to admit that I was not, I mean, I'm not an obsessive fan. Let's put it this way. I have never dressed as a Starfleet person in my life. So, although apparently.
The answer is no.
So the answer is no. I did actually follow the original series. So I knew that. But I actually knew George. I was following George like everybody else for this new late in life. Uh-huh. Comedy part of him, which, you know, again, in the who would have thunk category, you know, here's this guy who's just so incredibly hilarious and was sort of, you know, has become, I don't know, if I'm the gay Dave Barry, he's like, you know, the Asian Betty White or something. I mean, like, he's just become... And so I, you know, that's where he and I really, really connect. We both are huge fan of puns, which is really embarrassing, you know, because, you know, nobody
that's right, yeah,
nobody likes puns.
I know,
it's like
they've been programmed to think they're not supposed to.
Is that it, because people groan after them? Is that
yes, exactly, yeah. Yes,
yeah,
because like he and I were together in a green room waiting for an event, and we were seated together, and we sat down, and I said, look, this is a really nice couch. It's really comfortable. And he looks at me and he says, sofa, so good.
You even have his voice down pretty good.
Oh, you know what? Ask Leia Salonga. Everybody on the Allegiance team can imitate George. That's sort of a requirement for the show.
So if God forbid he has to miss a performance or two, there's no problem.
Well, I'm personally itching to go on for Leia Salonga, but yes, I am available for George Takei as well.
You do have a history in performance, don't you? I think I read that you did some opera.
I was an opera singer, and it's very exciting to me to be able to have brought Christopher and Nomura to the project. Chris was an opera singer with whom I did the justly unfamous production of Die Fledermaus in Eugene, Oregon.
Justly unfamous.
So he and I did this this production together, and we had, you know, we were roommates. And when we were looking for singers for the show, our music director, Lynn Shankle, was hunting for an Asian opera singer. She's Googling like crazy, and I'm thinking to myself, wait, I was an opera singer. Who do I know? And I suddenly went down the wormhole of memory to 18 years ago, thought about Chris Nomura and just Googled him to say, well, what's happened to him? It had been like 17 years. And it turns out while Lynn Schenkel, our music supervisor, was literally Googling around the globe, Chris lives down the street from her in Maplewood, New Jersey. They are no exaggeration, a mile away from one another. I sent him a message on Facebook and said, you know, who's your agent? And he came in on Monday and just absolutely made us all weep with this gorgeous classical instrument, as well as this incredible heart. You know, all we had to do, you know, because he is Japanese American, his parents are from Japan, he's what they call Nisei, and so all we had to say was, tell us about your father, and you know, the floodgates open. And that's happened a lot, because a number of the cast members have direct relationships to the internment. Like George, he, you know, who was raised in the camps, a lot of people are of second or third generation in the cast who have family and a personal connection to this story. So, you know, it really is a mission. There's a sense of commitment in the room that is absolutely transcendent.
Let's talk about some of your other projects, and I feel a parallelism happening here with one of your other projects is Chasing Rainbows, which is a musical based upon the adolescence of Judy Garland. So tell us about that.
This was another one that you would think, oh, Judy Garland, that story ends so tragically. Judy Garland, that tragic figure, this, that, and the other thing. But the producer came to me with this and said, I'm interested in telling the story of her adolescence. I want that spirited life force. And at the risk of being sort of like, otherwise, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? You know, it's the story wasn't all bad. Even when she was at MGM and getting hooked on amphetamines, she found a family, a lifelong family, in people like Kay Coverman, who was LB Mayer's secretary. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting story too, but we'll leave LBJ for another day. So her friendship with Mickey Rooney, her mentor Roger Edens, it definitely overlapped for me with how I paid for college, as being the outsider geeky kid who found a family, who found what Armistead Maupin calls your logical family versus your biological family.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what I saw in this story, this girl who is handed a stormy life, but still actually, you know, reaches for a rainbow in the course of that. I mean, and spent a lifetime reaching for that rainbow. And I think very often the storm overshadows the rainbow. And I was interested in finding out the other part of it. You know, Lorna Luft said quite famously about her mother that tragic things happened to my mother, but she wasn't the tragedy. And the key in for me, you know, Peter, this comes back to the question you posed earlier, is I don't know how many people you've interviewed who knew Judy Garland, but the one, if you look at all of those interviews in a row, it's really interesting because they all say the first thing out of, you know, June Allison's mouth or Mickey Rooney's or Peter Lawford's or anybody who was working at MGM. How funny she was. Absolutely. It's so interesting. And it gets completely overlooked. Every portrayal of her goes straight for, of course, you know, her great gift, which was to share this vulnerability. But this, like, wicked sense of humor that had everybody holding their sides totally goes missing from any depiction of her. And when they approached me about the project, I just said, oh, I get this woman. I feel like this is somebody that I would have hung out with as a teenager, and certainly as a gay man. I'm sure I would have been, you know, hovering her at the piano as well at a party. But I just thought, you know, the part of her that's like playing charades with Comden and Green always gets overlooked. So that's been my way into that story, and it's been... And, you know, because again, it really was, you know, a fulfillment of my mission. And, you know, Michael was there when I moved to New York. We met at another very hilarious person, Gerard Alessandrini, had a party, and we met there. And then I, being a real schnorrer, instantly, you know, invaded myself to become, you know, his plus Michael's plus one at any event I could. So Because I showed up with a couple of scripts in my bag, and here I am, you know, midlife trying to, you know, reinvent myself.
And Mark even told me, I know the rules, and he gave me the rules as he perceived them for being a plus one, and one of which is that you have to go to the things you don't think you're going to like as well as the things you really want to go to.
My wife doesn't follow that rule.
Oh, no, no, no. If you want to get invited to be somebody's plus one, you can't be just like, well, let me know when you see a Hamilton. You know, no. Yeah. You've got to be like, you want to go to Bushwick to see, you know, this
Heracles. Please, Prince of Child.
Yeah. I'll go to the opening of an envelope. I mean, I'll, you know, for me, fantastic. I love it all. I love it all. It was what was interesting was that I came with, you know, some of my own projects, but I've been developing. But then as I, you know, sort of met kindred spirits and, you know, started either, you know, waxing. Lecturing, if you will, about story structure and all the analysis that I had done of the structure of the musical. And the I'm not sure if any of you guys knew a company manager named Charlie Willard,
who was
from the 1980s.
Died tragically.
He died tragically, although he was in a boating accident on Lake Placid, mm-hmm. and they recovered everything but one leg. And I just... Mm-hmm. I don't know. There was just something about the fact that Charlie's leg was still in Lake Placid just always tickled me somehow. Mm-hmm. But Charlie was my mentor at Carnegie Mellon. He taught a class in musical theater text analysis that really changed the course of my life. Not just because it got me looking at musicals and deconstructing them. You know, this I had, you know, as a lifelong fixation on the musical and got me looking at it with new eyes. But also just as a critical thinker, the idea that you could just take apart a narrative and understand it. And I think that's what separates us from all other species. We're everything we tell.
The lower forms.
The lower forms, like, you know, like the people at the football game, for instance. But we, but you know, it is, our lives are a narrative. So there is this need to tell a story. And, you know, the need to tell a story as a musical goes back to the Greeks, which is why, you know, Something Rotten makes me apoplectic because, this burlesque of how musicals go about, there's a part of me that is just too much of a nerd and saying, that's not how it happened. And, you know, because the fact is, look at the Greeks. I'm totally off topic here. I was talking about Charlie Willard and how he would... You taught me about story structure, and suddenly I'm back at Aeschylus.
Yes,
I don't know how.
You need a moment of alignment here.
But I'd give anything to go see, to go back and see Something Rotten, to have you stand up and say, that's not how it happened.
This was a chance for me to be able to help other people tell their stories, basically. And as a result, I find myself able to overlap with other people's story. Actually, let's talk about Aeschylus. I really would love your opinion on this guy. Because my feeling is the Greeks, we give them credit for inventing drama, right? But then if you look at it, we know for a fact that they had instruments. We know for a fact they had choreography. They had something they referred to as the chorus, who quote-unquote chanted poetry. And I look at all of that evidence, and I think, that sounds like a musical to me.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So I don't know why we don't say they invented the musical theater. The only reason I think we don't is because the music didn't survive. So somehow we got into our heads that this was, you know, drama. But and this is how being an opera singer has really helped inform, you know, again, using every part of the buffalo, if you will. You know, the people who created opera, they created it in the Renaissance with an eye towards recreating Greek drama. Mm-hmm. So they understood that it was a musical theater. So that's why I do get upset when I see this divide.
Obviously.
Is it clear? Well, because I just feel like this is a medium that can be a vehicle for a religious experience. You know, the other thing about the Greeks is those plays were part of a religious ceremony, the festivals of Dionysus. You know, theater and the musical theater is my church. Mm-hmm. I go to learn to live a better life. And so when somebody craps in my church and turns it into a burlesque, I do. I get very upset. And when someone says, I'm going to use our church to tell you that life is, hopeless and that there is no, there is just no hope and no am I allowed to curse on this podcast?
Sure.
Yeah, so basically, if I'm going to be told there's a hole in the middle of a great black pit and it's filled with people who are filled with shit, like, sure, there's a place for that in the world, but that to me is intellectually not accurate about what the world is. And to throw Helen Keller into the Aeschylus something rotten mix here, her philosophy was that life is full of suffering, but it's also full of the overcoming of it. And that to me is what the musical can do, is it can take you into the crap hope continuum. Or since now I know I can curse, it's actually what we call the hope shit continuum. So there, that, my friends, is the gospel according to Mark. So.
Well, we all know that we can all think of wonderful, serious musicals that really do bring us to a higher plane. You just quoted from one of them. But also operas, I mean, needless to say, and as I mentioned before, this season, the Met Opera is doing a new production of Elektra. And if that doesn't speak to what you're talking about, I don't know what does. That goes right back to the Greeks.
Right.
And it's one of the most amazing cathartic operas you'll ever see in your life. So check that out.
Well, I'm interested to know from you guys whether you share this opinion. I do feel like after 9/11, the pendulum swung towards musical comedy, absolutely, mm-hmm. rightly so. But mm-hmm. I am feeling like in the zeitgeist that there seems to be an appetite for stories that have more calories, more less fewer empty calories and more protein on mm-hmm. the bone. What do you think? Are you seeing that evidence of that?
Yes, I do believe that the pendulum is swinging back there too, sure. We needed that 15 years ago very, very much. But I think we're getting back to a theater where allegiance will be welcomed. So I'm hoping it will be.
Let's just not screw it up. That's what we just keep telling ourselves at work every day. Okay, well, let's just not, F it up. And hopefully...
Mark, did they have to strap you down to a bed when Starlight Express was on Broadway?
I can't believe you invoked that.
You liked it, right?
Oh my God, so much so that I have like a long rant in Attack of the Theater People about Starlight Express because I was an usher on Broadway, and I was assigned Starlight Express. I have seen Starlight Express far more times than anyone has ever should have to. Wow. And
talk about internment camps.
It all comes back.
It was interminable. Absolutely. And I.
And now that Sweeney quote doesn't work for you now?
the thing about it, the thing about Starlight Express that I absolutely just also makes me angry is the, I mean, yes, it's the empty calories, but also the theme park quality of the production as well. Mary Martin in her biography or her memoir tells this beautiful story about performing The Sound of Music during a blackout. Mm-hmm. And they just gathered up every flashlight they could and everybody held a flashlight under their face mm-hmm. and they performed The Sound of Music. And I thought, you can perform The Sound of Music with a flashlight. In fact, I'd like to see a production of The Sound of Music performed with a flashlight. I think that'd be really interesting. You can't perform Starlight Express with a bunch of flashlights. So that simplicity, that the ability to be able to pass what Charlie Willard used to call the gym floor test, which is, could you perform it on the gym floor and would you be moved? And we all know those golden age musicals that you can see them with, a high school cast performing them badly in a low tech production, and they still not hit you where you live, because the spirit of them is so great. That's Yeah, I deliberately our set designer on Allegiance is Daniela Worley, who won the Tony for Peter and the Starcatcher, and she there are 70 scenes in the show requiring 103 settings. And she was saying this out loud and sort of casting daggers at me, you know, for like, how dare you write a musical with 70 scenes? It's very cinematic. And I just said to her, I said, Danielle, you realize it's because I hate scenery. I said, so I deliberately write so that you can't build anything to put on the stage. I don't want it. You know, for me, the you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, you know, a chorus line, what it meant, what it meant, what a musical meant was a chorus line. You know, bare stage, I hear you, Peter, so I think you must be in agreement. The, it's that, talk about hope, shit, continuum. When they walk out to the end of the stage and said, Daddy, I never thought I'd, you know, I was ever attractive. I'm misquoting, pardon me. I mean, that's sacrilege. I'm misquoting a chorus line. But when we go from that...
You are not the gay Dave Barry.
Straight Dave Barry knows this.
So when they go to the foot of the stage and they put their hearts on the line, and then the stage clears, you know, and the mirrors turn, and suddenly everything is beautiful, the ballet, and the stage goes to pink. And it's like I have been taken from earth to heaven. You know, in 3 minutes. And that's where it really, to me, that's where it comes back to the religious experience. That's what we are hoping to be able to do. And the thing about humor is that it is the gateway, you know, because if someone laughs, they are literally opened up. They have actually opened their mouths, and there's like an opportunity then to kind of dive in and grab someone's heart when you make them laugh. So it's really very manipulative, and I'm actually you know, it's part of my nefarious plan to move you by being a court jester. So
we look forward to it.
So I hear that Floyd is back with the puppy. So I'm going to let you get on with your Sunday morning. Mark, thank you so much for joining us and talking us with us about Allegiance and your other projects. We look forward to everything. And our listeners can catch up with Mark at markacito.com. And Allegiance the Musical is going to be coming around later on in the season. On November 8th, it opens at the Long Acre, and we will be talking about it after it opens. And Mark, we hope to have you back in the future.
Anytime. I would love it. Gentlemen, it's an honor. I've followed you all, so it's a pleasure to be able to have this conversation with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Peter, you got a chance to get down to the Pearl and see Midsummer Night's Dream. What did you think about it?
Well, this was the 19th time I saw this play. I've taught it in class, and I will tell you that if I didn't know the play, I wouldn't have any idea what was going on, because this is a five-person deconstruction, and under those circumstances, it's very hard to keep track of who's who. So, Eric Tucker is the guy who... conceived this. He's the director, and they don't help you at all in the playbill either. I've never seen this happen. You know, the standard cast list in the playbill has on the left hand side the name of the character that the person is playing. Then there are all those little dots going all the way to the actor's name on the right hand side. Well, this one have the actor's name on the left hand side. No problem there. But all the dots lead to nothing. They just have dots extending to the margin. So they don't tell you who's playing who. So they don't help you there either, you know. So it's almost like a diagramless crossword puzzle in a strange sort of way. So I don't know. You know, there's always been a lot of talk about digging up William Shakespeare's grave to see if he's really in there. You know, I mean, it'd be a good way to find out if there was a Shakespeare. You know, England doesn't want to do that because if it does happen, the myth will be gone. Well, but if the bard is in residence in that grave, I'm sure he's facing down now as to what happened here, because the play just doesn't make any linear sense under these circumstances. And the main event is really to tell the story, and I'm afraid this does not tell the story very well. I mean, my mind wandered so terribly, no matter how hard I tried to keep. I am thinking, you know, why do we call a person's gluteus maximus, to use a fancy term, his bottom, when really your feet are your bottom? I mean, you know, so this is what I'm thinking while I'm watching this, because, I mean, it's not holding me at all. However, what I will say, I was intent, and I mean intent, on jumping to my feet when it ended to give a standing ovation to these five people. My God, what they have to do, how many things they have to do, how many characters they have to play, obviously, so on and so forth. I do not blame the actors at all. They are really something to watch. But if you want to know anything about Midsummer Night's Dream, you got to wait for another production.
I think that's an issue. I also saw a Romeo and Juliet that had six people in it. There is a limit. There is.
I'm afraid,
you know, you can try to pay attention, and some of us know the play, at least some of the plays, pretty well. But you lose the sense of community, which is so important to most of those, all of those plays. I mean, they were written that way for a reason, not just to give people time on stage. So I completely agree with you. And in fact, Peter, I was interested in Midsummer, but then I saw the cast size and decided maybe I just.
Yeah.
Well, you haven't seen my one-person Romeo and Juliet, so I don't understand that. So last week we discussed Desire, but Peter got a chance to see it this week, so we're going to revisit it once again. So Peter, what did you think about Desire?
Well, the real reason to revisit it is to hear what Michael has to say, because there is the play that essentially is the sequel to the Glass Menagerie, and this one really does fascinate me, as it did Michael, because the idea of after Jim, the gentleman caller, as he's more greatly identified, after he finishes up at Tom and Laura's house, he goes to meet his girlfriend. And the thing is, we don't catch on for a while that it's his girlfriend. And I am telling you, Jim, go back and grab Laura while you can. I mean, this lady is not somebody that you want to be with for the rest of your life. I mean, this girl gabs on and on. Of course, it's 1948, so she's that's when he wrote the story. Obviously, Glass Menagerie was a few years earlier, but we do find out she's homophobic, but we'll understand that those were the times. But she goes on and on and on about a visit to her uncle, and she's suspecting that the man who lives with him, and the man is black too, which rubs her the wrong way, to say the least, may be his lover. So, but it's not until she finishes that he has the chance finally to get a word in and talk about his experience going to this house and his friend Shakespeare, which of course is the nickname that we do here in the Glass Menagerie for Tom, and working in a warehouse, and we're putting it all together, you know, that this is the gentleman caller. And it's just so great to hear his point of view on this. And one of the most interesting things to me was how much he liked Amanda. I don't know how I don't see how anyone can resist her, he says. You know, that's really nice. I mean, so many times, you know, I mean, like, I'm thinking of somebody we've had in the show that I met his mother and said, gee, she's charming. Oh, no, she's not. Oh, no, she isn't. I'm telling you right. You know, and we all react differently to people, and especially when it involves parents. So while Tom has a hard time with Amanda, Jim had a delightful time with Amanda. And that's certainly of more than moderate interest to me. Also, what I really liked was that Jim doesn't once mention that Laura has a disability. And that supports Amanda's contention that her daughter is too sensitive and the people wouldn't even notice her limp if she didn't make anything of it. You know, so that's what really interested me. And what I want to hear about, Michael, is what's the actual short story like? What did John Guare add? What did he subtract?
He basically added everything, as I suspected.
Wow.
I think I read this short story 30 years ago, probably in preparation for directing Glass Menagerie myself. And the story, Portrait of a Girl in Glass, basically mirrors the Glass Menagerie exactly. Starts in the same place and ends in the same place. So in this sense, John Guare was just using it as a jumping off point to then show us what he thinks happens when Jim, the gentleman caller, goes down to the Wabash Depot to meet Betty, who has been, she told him that she was going to visit her aunt in Centralia. I may have said something different last week, so forgive me. But that is the story she told him. And then thus the title of Guare's play, You Lied to Me About Centralia. She wasn't visiting her aunt. Mm-hmm. She was visiting this uncle. And then this whole completely concocted situation of the uncle turning out to be gay and living with a black man, which is certainly appropriate to a lot of Williams' other output. So I think that's really, really fascinating. Not what I expected at all, but I think Guare did a wonderful – I actually think it's one of the best things he's ever written. I really liked it. But another – just quickly, it's so interesting to notice the differences and the similarities between the short story and the Glass Menagerie. Some of it is almost verbatim. Some of it is verbatim and some of it's quite different. But for example, in the story, the gentleman caller, Jim, works at the warehouse with Tom. And in the play, we're told that he calls Tom Shakespeare. But in the short story, he just calls him Slim. So I think that was an improvement. This is interesting. In the show, in the play, we were told that the gentleman caller's name is Jim O'Connor. And then also at some point, it comes up somehow that his mother's maiden name was Delaney, which prompts Amanda to say Irish on both sides, and he doesn't drink. But anyway, in the short story, he's just called Jim Delaney, no O'Connor. So that's an interesting change. Oh, and then I think maybe the most interesting change of all is that whereas in the play there is that wonderful lengthy scene where Jim and Laura are left together in the living room while Tom and Amanda are off in the kitchen, and Jim and Laura have this beautiful, you know, coming together and discussion of their high school days, and then leading to the talk about the Glass Menagerie, and then the dance, which breaks the horn on the unicorn, which is symbolic and blah, blah, blah. Well, in the short story, all of that happens, but Tom and Amanda are present for all of it. So isn't that interesting?
They're sitting there in the living room?
Yes, they're just like with them. Or for most of it, they're definitely there. And in fact, the way the revelation comes up is that Laura is dancing with Jim, and Amanda is just delighted, and she says something about, oh, you can really dance, Mr. Delaney, and he says something like, oh yeah, you know, I go out dancing all the time with Betty, and she says Betty, blah, 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 blah. So I mean, I do think it's to look at the two of them and to see how it's beautiful to begin with, but how Williams improved it by thinking, you know, it would be better to have those two alone for that length of time. I think it really improves it, and that's a special talent to take something that's really solid to begin with and make it even better. Aside from translating it from a, you know, prose to dramatic literature, he really was just a genius.
All right. However, you know, the question becomes, I mean, I'm looking here at the actual playbill, and I'm seeing that Portrait of a Girl in Glass was written in 1948, which is after Glass Menagerie was produced. So, I mean, the fact that he improved the play seems out of sequence. So do you think this is a story that he wrote sometime before the Glass Menagerie and it wasn't published till 48? Do you have any theory on that?
You know, thanks for pointing that out. I think so. Yeah. I mean, that it certainly reads that way. Or maybe it's a typo. Is that possible?
Sure. You bet. I'm
really glad you mentioned that, Peter. I'm going to have to look it up.
Yeah, because
it really reads like a you know, a precursor.
The real question to me, too, is given that Tennessee Williams was first and foremost a dramatist, why did he choose to write these stories and not as plays? And I think I thought this more until you just told me what you just told me about how Guare took the play as a jumping off point. And it's entirely possible that every other playwright did the exact same thing and they're not literal representations of the stories. But there is one, Desire in the Black Masseur, another 1948 entry that I think would have been banned from the stage quicker than you can say Battle of Angels.
Absolutely.
Because this is one where a masochist goes to be punished, not only by a man, but a black man, and we're down south. And at that time, that was considered the most degrading thing you could do to yourself. So I don't know at all if indeed this is a case where Marcus Gardley, the playwright, just took a line or two and went off on a tangent the way John Guare apparently did. But I assumed that the reason it was a story is because in the privacy of our homes where we're reading a story, we can take a lot more than we can in an audience where we're wondering what other people are thinking and we feel self-conscious because how are we reacting, what our body language, people in behind us seeing how our body is flinching or not flinching or whatever. So I think it's easier I'll use the word salacious, which probably is what this story would have been considered back then. Salacious material is easier to take on the page than it is on the stage. Of course, the Long Rainbow of Calcutta certainly disputes this, but by and large, I think it is true that we can really be more at ease with more adventurous material on the page. So,
well, and I will say that it doesn't go without saying, but I would say that reading just this short story, one would think he could have had a career doing just that because it's so beautifully wrought in its own right that even if he never wrote a play, he would have been a wonderful short story writer. And they are two different mediums, and not everyone can do both. So,
What the stories are? What we have, six of them, and what we have are two. When he was told that he was all washed up, they were written late in life. One of them was when he was just starting out, and three of them when he was flying high. So he obviously had interest in writing short stories all along the way. And we do get a sampling from each time in his life, before he was Tennessee Williams, while he was Tennessee Williams, and while he was no longer regarded as a Tennessee Williams as a writer. So,
you tell me briefly, Peter, what you thought of the first one, the resemblance between a violin case and a coffin? Because as I said last week, that's where we see basically Tom and Laura, called Ro in that play, in their much younger years.
Well, I wondered if this was I had a different take on this, and that is I wasn't sure if Tom was Tom in the Glass Menagerie as much as Tennessee Williams himself, though, of course, he's certainly part of that in the Glass Menagerie. But the Roe struck me as Rose, his actual sister, as opposed to Laura.
I'm sorry, but that's I'm considering them the same people for our purposes.
I see, what interested me was the way the audience laughed when a new character came in named Richard Miles. Richard Miles was a violinist. Roe was a pianist. Tom always wanted to play in the backyard, but Roe wanted to play piano. And when Richard Miles came in, the audience gave a knowing laugh and say, well, we know he's going to come between brother and sister. And if there is a glass menagerie parallel here, it and certainly my girlfriend Linda thought there was, interesting thing at the end of this is the fact that she has more of a chance to love him and doesn't do it. And I thought that was a twist that I didn't quite expect. I thought it got the evening off to a good start, but not a great start. And the one that was always going to be of most interest to me was going to be the one by Rebecca Gilman, whose work I'm crazy about. So, and she didn't quite let me down in her short story, her version of The Field of Blue Children. I'm not going to say much about it because I want people to be surprised when they go. But I will say this, that I was wondering if the girls in the sorority we were watching, if the school they were going to was shiz, because there's a lot of Glinda in these girls, early Galinda, actually, in these girls who are in the sorority. And that wonderful line about they belong to Tri-Delts because they only know one letter of the Greek alphabet. That's a very good line. But, and I don't know if it's Gilman now or I don't know if it's Williams, but it's a great line. So you do meet a lot of bubbleheads here. And yet, every now and then, one of the bubbleheads comes out with a really incisive line. And that's really good, too, you know, because people aren't people who aren't very bright aren't stupid 100% of the time. Yeah, so there was a nice every now and then going back and forth, and we're really rooting for the girl here who has a little bit more on the ball than her sorority sisters. So I don't want to say too much, but I think that's the one that intrigued me the most next to the Guer one, because you just have to be I was on the edge of my seat with the Guer one.
Because, I know, right?
Yeah, you know, because, whoa, yeah. But in a way, I'm a little disappointed to hear that this is mostly Guer and not Williams. I would have liked to have thought that this is the way Williams saw the characters and saw Betty running off at the mouth and just going on and on, so, which is what I'm doing now, so I'm going to stop.
All right, both Michael and Peter got a chance to see the new morality down at the Mint. And Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
This is a wonderful, typically wonderful production by the Mint, one of our greatest off-Broadway companies, by a fellow named Harold Chapin. And let me just read to you what it says in the playbill here. A writer of wit, gaiety, and skillful craftsmanship. The Brooklyn-born British playwright Harold Chapin, 1886 to 1915, wrote 10 one-act plays and 4 complete full-length works before falling as a World War I soldier at the age of 29. Well, so big loss, as it turns out. He really, I guess, basically expatriated to England. It says, let's see, he was born in 1886 and then raised by a remarkable iconoclastic mother, the American-born actress, playwright, and feminist activist Alice Chapin, spent 4 years in prison after pouring acid into anti-suffrage pellet boxes. When Harold was 2 years old, Alice scandalously divorced his father, Harry Clark, and expatriated with her son to London, where she nurtured the theatrical talents of her children. So, I mean, it could write a play about the playwright. Mm. But this play, The New Morality, is a really delightful piece that turns out, seems like it's going to just be a comedy, and then it gets into some really interesting, more serious questions. The setup is the simplest thing you could imagine. This woman and her husband, Betty Jones, and her husband, Colonel Ivor Jones, live on a houseboat somewhere in England, and it's around 1911, 1912. And Betty has just confronted their neighbor, Mrs. Wister, because Betty feels that Mrs. Wister has been too flirty with her husband and that her husband has maybe responded a little too well to the flirtiness. And so that's the setup, but we don't even see that happen. That happens just before the play actually begins. And then we see discussion of that and her version of what happened. And then the husband of the lady who was yelled at shows up, and he is trying to seek an apology on the behalf of his wife. And then Betty's brother also shows up. And then the only other two characters are a manservant and a maid. So it's pretty slight in a way, but it gets into some very interesting discussions about husband-wife relationships, especially at that time in that milieu, in that country. And one of the most interesting things I thought was the sort of exploration of how responsible is anyone for their spouse's behavior. I think that's a really interesting question, and that's dealt with. Just beautifully produced, acting stellar across the board, incredible sets and costumes, as always at the Mint. They're just the best. So I was, and as I've said, they're not always 100% successful in the excavation that they do in digging up lesser known plays, but I would say that the productions are always good regardless, and their track record of the as far as the worth of the plays that they find is extremely, extremely good. The occasional misfire is certainly worth the vast majority, which are really, really always so interesting and so good. So I'd like to hear what Peter thought.
Well, I didn't think I was going to respond to it, because one of the things that does happen in the play is that because there has been this contention between these two women, there may be a lawsuit. And there's a lot of talk about whether or not this is going to go to court. And I was thinking along the way, you know, it's much more interesting to be in court and see the argument rather than hear that they may go to court. The stakes are obviously higher when you go to court. But it, as Michael says, this is, as it goes on, it really does pick up. And Mr. Wister, who's played in a silly fashion all the way through the first two acts, has a long, long speech that really shows. It's funny, I was just saying about how stupid people are not stupid 100% of the time. He seems silly, but he's not silly 100% of the time. What he is, he has a lot of trenchant observations to make in that third act, which really silences everybody who listens to him intently. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, and that's what's really, really, when the play really comes together. Because the stakes suddenly get much higher as we don't worry about whether or not they're going to go to court. We're worried about the way these people are seeing this matter. Yes, of course, the English class system comes into play here in the sense that people are just so offended, and high class people do not treat high class people this way, all that type of thing. Betty Jones, played by Brenda Meaney, is sensational at being this highborn woman with this elegance about her and a no-nonsense demeanor as well. She's a tough cookie as well as an elegant one. And mixing those two together, she comes up with something really, really wonderful. Yes, the Mint always does wonderful, wonderful, wonderful work with their productions. You may not always like the play. And I'm not saying this would be in my top 10 Mint experiences, but it certainly was a play worth investigating. And more to the point, we do think of what we might have had this gentleman not got on to war and get himself killed at the age of 29, because it does not seem to be the work of a 29-year-old playwright, because it does deal with such issues about people who've been married for a long time. One has to wonder if this is his parents' story in to some degree, but it doesn't seem to be that it would be something he would notice from his friends, because these people are substantially older than 29, and if they're not, they certainly acted. And that makes a big difference here, too, to think that he was so aware. In a strange way, this play is very Chekhovian. Who knows? Maybe this gentleman who died young, as Chekhov did, maybe he would have turned out to really be something if he had the extra, what, dozen or so years that Chekhov had.
Yeah.
Who knows? Who knows? But again, Jonathan Bank deserves a lot of credit for saying, this one is worth a look, you know, and it was worth a look, you know, and so those who are curious about this will find that once again, the Mint has put on stage a look of elegance. These are technically shoestring productions in the sense that you're in a theater that is not an elegant playhouse, and it's a very small stage and all that. But boy, do they make do with what they have and
yes.
go above and beyond the call of duty. Because there's no question, none whatsoever, that if we walked in there and saw lesser quality sets and costumes, we wouldn't be surprised because of the nature of the playhouse itself. You have to take an elevator to the third floor, you know, I mean, that type of thing. It's in an office building. You don't expect that you're going to get the quality you get just from by the way of walking in there. It doesn't seem like you're going on a night on the town when you go to the Mint because it's such a modest environment. But boy, when the lights go down and you see what's on that stage, and what's also wonderful is if they have to change sets, I get the impression that Jonathan Bank doesn't say, well, there are too many sets here, we're not going to do it. If he wants to do a play, he does it. There are two sets here. I shouldn't make it sound like there are 17. But both of them involve a good deal of set design and manpower to get them to look the way they do, and changing the set. The second two acts, two and three, are on the same set. But, you know, there has to be a good deal of jostling around during intermission to get everything into place. So I remember when Annie 2 was being refurbished as Annie Warbucks, and it was going to be down at the Variety Arts Theater. One of the producers of Annie Warbucks said, there's really something wonderful when you go off Broadway and you see a show that's really too big for the theater. I think that's true of the Mint sets. So I think it works better with the Mint sets than it did with Annie Warbucks. But anyway, okay.
All right. So that is playing through October 18th. Down at the Mint on 311 West 43rd Street. We'll have a link to that in our show notes. Michael, did you jump on the Staten Island Ferry and go over to see Reasons to be Pretty?
I certainly did. I saw it at Seaview Playwrights Theater, which is a theater where I had directed several shows many years ago, including The Glass Menagerie and Streetcar Named Desire and Bent. But they do... You know, they do the tough stuff, and they're doing Reasons to be Pretty, which is, I think, one of my favorite of Neil LaBute's plays. They're usually, I would say all of them are not necessarily easy to sit through. They're very disturbing in one way or another. This is to just remind people or to inform those who never have seen it. The catalyst of this drama is that Greg and Steph are a couple, or at least for the moment. But their relationship is in deep peril because Greg had said something to someone else that implied that Steph was maybe not that pretty, and this got back to her, and there is much very heated discussion about what exactly he said, what he meant, and him apologizing and going back and forth, and just it really goes from bad to worse, let's put it that way. And then there are two other characters, Kent and Carly, who are friends of the other two, and they figure into the drama because they're married, and their relationship may not be perfect either. And it's about honesty, it's about deception, it's about insecurity, all of these things that come up in relationships. And LaBute does all of that very, very well. So this was done at Seaview Playwrights Theater, directed by Karen O'Donnell, an old friend of mine. But I didn't know anyone in the cast because it's sort of the new generation of Staten Island theater. I'm not really involved that much anymore. Greg was Anthony Noto. Steph was Marissa Terzino. Kent was Craig Kwasnicki. And Carly was Cheryl McLeod. And not all shows on Staten Island are great. They sometimes bite off more than they can chew, I think, when they try to do things like Shaw or the classics, because frankly, I mean, we're not talking about professional actors here. We're talking about amateurs, often very, very, very talented. But in cases like this, where people don't have to necessarily stretch to do dialects and to get a certain style with which they're not necessarily familiar, you can get excellent productions, as was the case here. I think it was very wise of them to choose this. All of the actors seemed completely natural. They inhabited their roles 100%. The direction was spot on, and I think I almost like the play better seeing it this time than when I saw it on Broadway. That may be partly just because of having more opportunity to think about it. But it was a stellar production, and they should all be very proud of it, especially for, again, not one of them is a professional actor or director. So really, 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 really good job.
Well, they may not be, but one of them may have had a certain brush with professional theater, because you mentioned Anthony Noto, N-O-T-O?
Yes.
Well, I do know Laurie Noto, who produced The Fantastics, had a son named Anthony who worked with him on The Fantastics. I wonder if this could be the same person. I mean,
I'm thinking this person would be considerably younger.
Younger, yeah. That did occur to me. But it's
maybe it's his funny. Grandson.
Grandchild, yeah.
Yeah, it could very well be. Could very well be. But that name does come up. So that did interest me. It really is a good play, isn't it? Because when it really comes down to brass tacks, when you're involved with somebody, you really like to think that the person you're involved with thinks you're attractive. You know, even if you're not, you'd like to think that one person who supposedly loves you thinks you're attractive. And that's one of the more galvanizing questions and answers that this play offers.
And another interesting thing about this play is that, in my opinion, only one of the characters is likable, and that's mm-hmm. Greg, played by mm-hmm. Anthony Noto. The other three are really they're quite
Aren't
awful
they?
People in
Aren't
one way
they?
Or another. Yeah.
Aren't they?
So I'm not sure. I can't think of offhand of another case like that where there's one likable character and everybody else is a bitch or a bastard.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So really interesting work for LaBute. I almost wish that I had kind of maybe tried to, I mean, obviously I didn't know how good the show was going to be until I saw it, and I saw the second to last performance or third to last performance. But I wish he had known about it. I think he would have really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. So in the genre of desire where people take a play and write the subsequent discussion after it, if you were to have Reason to Be Pretty and it was like a first date for somebody in the audience, what would that discussion be after the play?
That's a good question.
you want to check out the play you're going to take a first date to before you actually take them to.
Well, if you recall when I went to see Queen of the Night.
Oh,
which,
yes.
Completely different, but there's in that show there were kind of very intense sexual situations, somewhat dominant, submissive, and blah blah blah. And I had heard that the very, very attractive, very upper class, couple next to me were on their first date, and so I turned to her at one point and said, "So."
Uh-huh. How's it going?
And fortunately, she laughed.
I think I may have mentioned this, but the first date I ever took a girl on, I took her to see Psycho. So, no, it was carefully planned. I figured she'd get scared and snuggle up to me.
Exactly. We knew exactly what you were doing.
Oh, I see.
All right. Somebody who knows exactly what he's doing is Denzel Washington. So Denzel is going to be directing all 10 of August Wilson's plays on HBO. And I thought that this was amazing, and my mind ran with lots of different possibilities. With maybe they can bring them all to Broadway, and they can record them or film them at the time. But that doesn't seem to be happening. But I'm very excited about this. What do you guys think?
Me too. I adore August Wilson's plays, and I can never get enough of them. And it'll be nice to see some of the ones that don't get that much attention, like Jitney, get the attention, because that's a very good one. That's definitely worth seeing. The retrospective aspect of this is really good too, because we will have moments that we will remember saying, "Oh yeah, I remember that. That was so good. What a smart thing! Boy, did this guy know human behavior?" I love the moment in Fences where somebody's telling a story and somebody comes in and says, "Your girlfriend just called. She's waiting for you. You're supposed to be." He says, "Oh yeah." And he sits down and gets even more comfortable. He's not going until he hears the end of the story. Little details like that are so wonderful, and nobody did it better than August Wilson.
Yes, and Jitney's a personal favorite of mine as well. But
so wonderful to hear, you know, that here's a guy with a ninth grade education, went to the library, learned it all himself, and that is so wonderful. An inspiration to us all, really.
All right, so before we get into trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link that way each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, or Android device. And stream us directly to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, or for me, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, can be found at BroadwayRadio.com. So, Peter, why don't you give us the answer to last week's trivia?
Well, the question was, because we had celebrated Labor Day, my mind turned to a song that mentioned Labor Day. I said it came from a hit musical that was later made into a film. Some years later, New York saw it again live in a major production. By the way, notice I said New York saw it. I did not say Broadway. I did not say off-Broadway. Okay, there was a reason for that, as you'll see. Almost two decades later, a TV version was aired. The name of the song in which Labor Day is mentioned also happens to be the name of a Broadway musical that had been produced the same year, but not the same season. What's the name of the song and the name of the musical for which it came? Now, my favorite answer came from Josh Israel, who said, you know, I don't think this is right, but, you know, Rent almost works, because Labor Day is mentioned in one of Alexi Darling's voicemail. It did run on Broadway. It did have a movie. It did have a New York revival off Broadway. You know, that counts. It had that live TV film version. He said, I'm not sure it was ever shown on TV, but, you know, there was the second incarnation of it. He said, so, you know, he made it very clear. He said, you know, I know this is not right, but isn't it interesting how close Rent comes? He said, because one of the songs in Rent is Contact, and that was a musical. You know, well, as he wrote, okay, not actually a musical, but the Tony Committee was fooled. Anyway, so he said, you know, look, I know I'm not right. I'm just telling you, isn't it interesting how close Rent comes? So, yes, he's quite right. However, Jed Slaughter from Tacoma, Washington, did get it right, because the song was All American from Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, which had a Broadway production, then a film, and then it appeared at the State Theater at Lincoln Center with Sammy Davis Jr. And then Peter Scolari in 1996 did a TV version. So, and of course, All American was a musical that Strauss and Adams wrote in 1962. It was part of the 1961-62 season, while Stop the World opened in late 62 and was part of the 62-63 season. So congratulations to Jed Slaughter, who really was very good at figuring this one out, which was not an easy one.
Excellent. So, Michael, you have a trivia question for us. Go right ahead.
Yes, before I do, I did want to actually send a shout-out to another of our listeners, Jeff Daugherty, who was the one who sent me the copy of Portrait of a Girl in Glass. So I really, really appreciate that. I really love reading it. But, yes, trivia. This is drawn from Andy Probst's wonderful bio of Cy Coleman, You Fascinate Me So. Andy was a guest on the podcast several weeks ago. And I always find it fascinating to read about and hear other performers who were considered for major roles did not wind up doing them for one reason or another. And in the case of Sweet Charity, when they were preparing to make the film, obviously many names were mentioned, but one name apparently that was mentioned a few times was a lady who was quite a big star at the time, and she apparently said that she really, really wanted to do it. And she did not wind up doing it. It, of course, went to Shirley MacLaine. But this lady who really wanted to do it, she was in a few musical films, I would say, at least one of which is extremely famous, but not thought of primarily as a musical theater or a musical film actress. But again, really, really a big, big, big star. So the question is, who is that person?
By the way, speaking of Shirley MacLaine, I spoke to her the other day because she's going to be in town on Monday the 28th at 7 o'clock at City Center, where the Career Transition for Dancers annual jubilee is taking place.
Oh, yes.
And she's going to be given a Lifetime Achievement Award. And I have to tell you, she was one of the most delightful interviews I have ever had, and I'm very happy to be able to say that. So maybe you should show up at Career Transition for Dancers at City Center, and because I have a feeling when she gets the award, she's going to give a very gracious speech.
Well, if you know the answer to that, please email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and I will put a link to the Career Transitions for Dancers in the show notes as well. And a quick reminder that next Sunday, the 27th, is the 29th annual Broadway Flea Market and Grand Auction. So I hear that Peter's going to be there. You going to be there, Peter?
You bet I'll be there.
So if you want to catch up with Peter and find him there, Michael's going to be at the Tennessee Williams Festival up in Provincetown. Is that correct?
Yes.
And I will be at a soccer field to be named. I don't know. I'm supposed to be somewhere on Sunday. So we'll be recording next Sunday a little bit early, but you can still expect it on the Monday morning podcast of your choice. And so on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
When the world is upside down, find the upside, turn around, and be the kind of man to make pop proud. No, be the kind of man to make me proud. What makes a man isn't what he says, it is what he leaves behind. What makes a man